Your student radio station. Your student sound.
Yes, hello, the time is 2 p.m. I'm Theo Hunt and you're listening to Newspeak, the best political discussion show on 87.7 Berwick FM and the most criticised show on Lank Fashion. This is Newspeak, this is Freedom of Speech going live as we debate the big issues of the past week. We had a week off last week, but we're back and raring to go. Our first guest this week is LGBT plus officer at Lancaster University Labour Club, Adam Stowe. Great to have you with us, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I know there was a bit of a mix-up and fault partly on my side for not getting anyone from Labour the past few weeks, but it's really, really good to have you with us. I'm really looking forward to having you in part of the discussion today. We also have a member of Lancaster University Conservative Society, Guy Watts, with us as well. Guy, how are you doing?
I'm super, thank you, Theo. Really, really glad to be joining Lancaster's most controversial political speech show.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, that's what we're going with. But before we get on to the debate, there's a lot to talk about from the past week. We'll start with our main news roundup. As always, we'll move on to our first discussion topic on Keir Starmer. We'll then have the alternative news roundup and our final two debates on the royal family and how you would survive on a desert island. All the headlines and opening monologues in this show are brought to you with the help of the BBC, The Week, The Economist, Metro and the World Health Organization. So what's been in the headlines this past week? Well, here are the big stories. In the UK, the vaccine rollout continues, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledging that all adults will be offered their first dose by July. This pledge comes alongside news that daily infection rates are declining, as are transmissions by those with the vaccine. 2 days ago, Johnson also unveiled a roadmap out of England's lockdown, promising that schools will be open on 8th of March, and all restrictions, including on social distancing, could be lifted as early as the 21st of June. President Joe Biden has declared a major disaster in the American state of Texas after major snowstorms and temperatures of minus 18 degrees Celsius overwhelmed the Lone Star State's energy grid, leaving millions without power and water for days. 80,000 homes were still without power on Saturday. Biden's announcement allows for more federal support in the state, which has seen nearly 60 deaths, despite being dubbed the energy capital of the world. Governor Greg Abbott has thanked Biden, calling his decision an important first step. And NASA is releasing astonishing images sent back from Mars by the new Perseverance rover, which made a successful landing on the red planet last Thursday. This is the fifth rover to be put on Mars by NASA and will aim to last roughly 2 Earth years. As it searches for life and sends rock samples back to Earth. The quality of the photos is far better than any before, with Katie Stack Morgan, Deputy Project Scientist, describing how we're picking out different colours and tones and textures for the first time. Would thoroughly recommend having a look at those if you haven't seen them yourselves. And those are the big headlines. We'll have our alternative news roundup in just a moment. But move on to our first big debate topic. If you at home listening in want to comment, ask questions or respond to any of this discussion, you can message me personally or feel free to message the studio PC at, and this is the number, 01524 566 549. I'll say that again, 01524 566 549. The system can be a little bit complicated receiving messages, so if you just put Newspeak 24 at the top of your message, that'll make it much easier for me to read and respond to those. But now on to the debate. Sir Keir Starmer is fast approaching a year in office as leader of the Labour Party and the opposition. There's increasing scrutiny of his qualities, or lack of them so far. He made a substantial speech on the state of Britain last Thursday, and it's had a mixed reception. Will Huston in The Guardian says Starmer's caught the national mood. Robert Colville in The Times blames only the Labour Party for holding him back, but The Economist describes him as stuck. Andrew Pearce in The Daily Mail argues he's on a journey to nowhere. Guy, I'm going to ask you to come on this first. Before we look at where Starmer's heading, let's look at where he's come from these past 10 months. What would be your summary of his performance so far?
Oh, well, Captain Hindsight, a lovely topic of discussion to kick this off. He really hasn't been very impressive at all. When the Labour Party elected him, I thought people thought, oh, this is going to be a clean sweep from Jeremy Corbyn, pushing the 2019 general election victory, loss in their part, under the carpet, move on to a bright new future. But he's just embroiled in infighting after infighting. And every time throughout this coronavirus pandemic, where there have been multiple opportunities for him to criticise the government on the handling of various different topics, I'll kind of hardly admit the government hasn't handled the coronavirus pandemic very well at all, to the best extent it could have done. But he hasn't been very good at tackling that. And you just have to kind of review everything. For example, when the government recently announced that they were going to bring back schools on March 8th, he came back and said schools must open on March 8th. So he's just trying to play catch up with the government at the moment. And I love the description I saw online the other day that he is the epitome of that basic Tesco meal deal of a basic ham sandwich, plain Evian water. Obviously, other water brands are available, and some ready salted crisps. So I think that kind of sums up where he is. Where I think he's being held back on that, obviously, we'll come on to in a minute. But I think it's a mixture of, honestly, bland policy, a bland leader, and a party which is just split in half once again.
OK, so missed opportunities, not taking the government to task properly. Adam, do you kind of agree with Guy's assessment there?
Yeah, I've got to be honest. I agree with the majority of what Guy has said. I think when Keir Starmer was elected leader, for full disclosure, I voted for Rebecca Long Bailey in the leadership contest. But I think a lot of people on the left, you know, a lot of my friends, they saw Keir Starmer as this opportunity to be Jeremy Corbyn with a nicer haircut and a better media approachability. And I think that was quite deceptive on Starmer's part. I know in his campaign, he was very, very hard to pin down what his actual politics were. And I think that was like a deceitful attempt to win over voters on the left. And once he won the nomination, I think he started to show his true colours.
Okay, and that's fine. Go on.
Yeah. So I think like one of the first major signs that something wasn't right is when he sacked Rebecca Long Bailey as Education Secretary for siding with the unions. You know, one of Keir Starmer's 10 pledges that are still on his website to promote the trade union movement. The Labour Party is a party of organised labour. And so far, he's disagreed with the unions, he's silenced anyone that's tried to promote the unions, and he's put workers' lives at risk in some cases, especially when calling for schools to open before unions said it was safe.
Okay. So we've got kind of Starmer letting down the left in that situation. So interesting to hear kind of your opening thoughts. And Guy, I'm going to return to you first. You mentioned Starmer's kind of playing catch-up. He's just not taking the government to task. You don't think this is a fairly stupid move on his part to broadly support the government and wait until it flubs a post-pandemic response? Because it's obviously unpopular to be going against the government in these tough times of crisis. You want to show patriotism and support. You don't think he's trying to just keep on the right side of the argument until a decisive opportunity opens for him to take Boris Johnson to task?
Well, the issue is he isn't, though. That's the problem is there have been countless opportunities where he can press the government to do more. Look back at Test and Trace, a prime example. He just didn't press hard enough. It was a very, very simple kind of answer that he could have pushed very hard on Test and Trace, for example. But all he's doing is just telling the government what they've already planned to do. Remember that the government's got a massive civil service behind him, and he's not picking holes in it. He's just saying, you need to do this. And the government's just simply going back, saying, you're doing that. We're doing this already. And it's really catching him out a bit as well. And I think today in PMQs, he's pushing for this £500 payment for everybody who's under self-isolation. Now, this is something that's been we were talking about 4 or 5 weeks ago in the press and on social media about how if you give somebody £500 for self-isolating, regardless, people are just going to go and, you know, you get £500, you can go get a fine for £800 and take the profit. So it's getting into this spinner where he's not taking the government to task on the right issues. There have been a multitude of things. For example, the furlough scheme, you know, the 3 million people who, for one or a better term, have been missed out because of the furlough scheme, because of their self-employment scheme. And he hasn't taken the government to task on simple things like that. And they're having to resort to online campaigns because the leader of the opposition isn't being a leader of the opposition. He's simply just saying, oh, yeah, government, we agree with you on this. And then the government simply walking over him. It's one of those ones too. And I'd say just on just what Adam said about RLB and Rebecca Long Bailey. I believe she was. I thought she was sacked for the whole anti-Semitic conspiracy theory side of things, not necessarily the unions piece. But I thought that was just him trying to big cut from the past and put the whole anti-Semitism side of the Labour Party to one side. And that's why I thought he sacked RLB in the first place.
Quite possibly, yeah. Although, obviously, that's not necessarily adding a broader point about the union, but I think Rebecca Long Bailey was because she shared an article in which someone discussed a theory about, I've forgotten the details, about, I think, Israel or Israeli police being involved in some criminal activity.
Yeah, what it was is she shared an independent interview with Maxine Peake on her Twitter, and then there was a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff between the leader of the opposition's office and her, and there were some dodgy things that went on internally that led to her sacking.
But to go to the issue of Labour and the unions, I mean, you've got Starmer saying all teachers should be vaccinated. Isn't that something that the unions are supporting? Isn't he trying to protect kind of workers in this instance?
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is his views seem to shift so much, and when he thought it was advantageous to part with the unions, he would quite happily throw them under the bus. And then when he thinks it's going to benefit him, he'll quite happily back them again. And just to like the wider point of like Keir's slow start, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I think when Keir took over the leadership, he thought he was going to have, you know, a good few months of not having to really do anything. I think he, you know, when he unveiled a new leadership slogan and he had that little press conference at the start, and he was trying to set his own image and he thought he would have a lot of time to settle into the role, and I think he thought he could out-sensible Boris to a degree. I think he thought if he just spared his time, said the right things, made sure the press didn't skewer him like they did Jeremy Corbyn unfairly, I reckon he thought he could maybe creep up in the polls and come the local elections, throw in a few policies, and maybe think he could beat Boris like that. But that's not what happened. Instead, Keir Starmer became leader of the opposition in what I would probably call the most like tumultuous time since the Second World War. And rather than having a leader of the opposition that just sits back and lets the government defeat itself, which I think was Keir's initial plan, we really need a strong leader of the opposition that presents a viable alternative. And I think that's why Jeremy Corbyn was so strong. You know, for all his downsides, you could quite easily say Jeremy Corbyn had an alternative view for Britain. Keir Starmer, I think the only policy I can remember that he's brought out was when he announced in his speech the other day about government bonds, and I hardly think that's going to be a vote winner. And yeah, and I think with Boris Johnson, you can't out-sensible him. I don't think anyone, not even the Conservative Party, thinks Boris Johnson is sensible. I think very few people think he's even that competent. But that's, you know, that's not why people back Boris. They back Boris for other reasons, which, yeah, I disagree on, but that's up to them. But they don't do it because they think he's a sensible, competent leader. They do it because it's Boris. So I think a strategy of trying to be big sensible, trying to out-forensic Boris, isn't going to win any votes. It's not going to get us anywhere as a party. I think what Keir really lacks is vision.
Okay, so what you're saying about Starmer out-sensibling Boris, because Boris is obviously the Heineken politician, right? His, supposedly because his marketing is like that of Heineken, which gets everywhere and everyone's familiar with it. But do you think Starmer isn't trying necessarily to out-sensible Boris, but to trip him up by being sensible, by being loyally and focusing on the details? Because Johnson, I think, struggled in City Hall. He was Mayor of London when Labour representatives got under his skin and focused on the details and picked him on the administrative issues. Don't you think Starmer could well be doing that?
I think that could work if the press were so, I guess, lenient towards Boris. I know that they call him out occasionally, but I think any news story about Boris, it slips from a cycle within a day. You know, there's the Dominic Cummings fiasco when he went to Barnard Castle or whatever. That just slips the public consciousness. The press are, at the moment, I think, doing a really poor job of holding the government to account. I know the leader of the opposition should be doing that, but the, you know, the whole idea behind the free media is that they hold the government to account as well. And at the moment, they just seem to be republishing government press briefings.
Guy, do you agree with that?
I'll take issue just what was just about the whole Cummings fiasco. Yeah, it was one of those ones where it spun out of control thanks to the kind of media that we've got in this country. And they focused on that for some weeks. If you ever remember back to summer last year, they were banging on about every day. So I think it's a bit mysterious to say that kind of slipped under conscious. People still very much remember the whole Cummings fiasco. And I think it was unfairly portrayed on Boris because it was a senior advisor at the end of the day. It wasn't Boris who'd broken the rules, but it had reflected badly on him. And again, it was one of those times where the Labour Party really didn't. It was the press who were holding the government to account over the actions of their special advisor. It wasn't the Labour Party. They just said, oh, resign. And that seems to be the Labour Party's official response to pretty much every time something goes wrong. They don't try and highlight any other broader issues within the parties or government or issues. They just say, oh, you should just resign. And I think that's a big part of just the Keir Starmer thing. He just thinks everything should be based on resign or not, basically. But yeah, I think in terms of what was just kind of said, and in terms of the vaccination teachers thing, this is a vaccination teachers. It's a contentious issue, right? Because we've got some of the brightest minds in this country working on SAGE, the JVCI, the vaccination committees, all looking at this, and they aren't saying we need to vaccinate teachers. And the reason is, well, there is evidence to say if we stop now, if we stop right in the dead in our tracks of our vaccination rollout program, which is almost world leading, especially in Europe. We are way ahead of everybody. 18 million doses, which is a fantastic achievement for something which a year ago we weren't really panicking about at this point. But in terms of it, they're spouting stuff about to the scientists, saying scientists need to look into this. They're not telling the government what to do. They're saying they're attacking the wrong people and they're going after the wrong kind of trends here, which again kind of sums up their communication strategy as well. We're heading into May elections this year, and I have personally no idea about what the Labour Party is going to sell that, because the most of the councils that are coming up in for re-election in May 2021 are mostly Conservative-controlled councils, with a couple non-controlled ones with, either it's split between red and blue, or it's got Greens and Lib Dems mixed in there somewhere else. I have no idea how they're going to tackle that, because there just doesn't seem to be any kind of clear policy. I don't know what the Labour Party stand for. And Keir Starmer, he came out today or yesterday, he's spoken to the NFU. And he's going down that line. He's steering away in all loads of different directions. And I don't think there's any clear policy. And I think what's really happened here is the Labour Party are going down this line where they saw the car crash of the 2019 election. They saw one big thing about left. They were throwing loads and loads of policies about nationalisation, free internet, and people who, with their tax monies, would think, I don't want my money spent like that. I don't want it spent on all these useless nationalisation products. And that's why they voted Tory. And now Keir Starmer has gone completely on the reverse foot, and he's putting out no policy, effectively. He's just saying, he's coming out with mantra. He's not coming out with actual any policy, because he's frightened of going down that line of policy that was kind of said by Jeremy Corbyn in 2019.
Okay, I'm just gonna interrupt your mind. If you have just tuned in, you are listening to me. You're listening to Newspeak with me, Theo, and my guest Adam and Guy. We've been discussing Keir Starmer as Labour Party leader. Guy just raised an interesting point about Starmer trying to be the anti-Corbyn in introducing no policies. I remember when Corbyn unrolled universal broadband at Lancaster Uni last year, not necessarily the most kind of evocative rallying cry to mobilise students. But Adam, interesting. There's a couple of questions that kind of combine in my head here. Laura Kunzberg, the BBC's political editor, recently suggested within the Labour Party there's a desire to rattle the cages as though Starmer and those at the top. There's also curious questions over, is it the Labour Party that's holding Starmer back in the polls? Because Starmer's polling about equal with Johnson, possibly now falling behind. Is it that Starmer would be doing higher if he was with a different party? How much do you kind of buy into that opinion?
I think if Starmer was leader of a Conservative Party, he'd have a very good run at things. But, yeah, I don't think if Starmer doesn't have views that are consistent with the membership of the Labour Party, it is not the Labour Party holding Keir Starmer back. It is Keir Starmer distorting what the Labour Party is. And I think people have really given Keir Starmer a lot of leniency within his first year. Yeah, I know members of the Socialist Campaign Group, it's a group of MPs within the Labour Party, they have held their tongue on many occasions when they thought, when otherwise, people like me would have probably shouted at him you know, metaphorically speaking. You know, a lot of MPs on the left have tried to afford Starmer, you know, a good deal of leniency, a good deal of settling in period. And time again, he's just sort of thrown it out the window and being useless with it. I don't think the Labour Party is at all holding Keir Starmer back, you know. And I think, if anything, I think we can see with the fiasco with the Liverpool mayoral candidate selections. So if people that don't know, there were three candidates running for the Labour nomination for mayor of Liverpool. And one of the left candidates looked likely to win it. And, you know, the membership were behind, you know, these candidates. And due to internal party procedures, they've basically just completely closed that nomination process, reopened it, and said the candidates can't apply now. It's massively undemocratic. I think one of the good things that Jeremy Corbyn did is he made the party more answerable, more accountable to the membership. And that's what we should be as a political party. We should be a democratic mouthpiece. We should reflect the values internally that we want to promote externally. And Keir Starmer just seems to have completely, how to put this without being sweary, messed it up, you know.
Thank especially you for not being sweary.
Yeah.
Okay, and I can understand your point there, which is the Labour Party trying to hold its tongue on Starmer. But I suppose what lies behind my question is, especially following the 2019 defeat, especially following Corbyn, especially, you know, if you're of a certain age, you still remember Kinnock and Foote and the Blair-Brown arguments. Do you still not think, I've started the question poorly, do you not think the Britain, the electorate, still views the Labour Party with distrust, whatever the Labour Party does, however democratic or non-democratic it is? Just the public perception of the Labour Party is a block on Starmer.
So I think the years of press bashing that occurred when Jeremy Corbyn took over have definitely had some sort of effect. I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of cultural hegemony, but
a little, but do go for it. Yeah,
to expand, it's the idea that when there is a dominant ideology, it sort of permeates all aspects of society. So the press are going to conform to that ideology, the courts are going to conform to that ideology, all the political institutions are going to conform to that ideology, and create a whole culture that's aimed at protecting this ideology. And Jeremy Corbyn, you know, he was a threat to the status quo in Britain. You know, he was the first, I think, Labour leader since probably Michael Foote to offer something, you know, radically different to the path we're on now. And I think the press sensed this, and everyone just stopped for a second and thought, oh, you know, this person is threatening how, you know, how we're running things. He's offering a maybe a social democratic vision for the country. And I think there was a lot of conspiring to stop him in that. And I think that's why the press was so particularly vicious towards Jeremy Corbyn, because he was offering something different. Keir Starmer, who's offering nothing, hasn't had like nearly half as much vitriol from the press because of this.
Okay, I mean, Guy, do you kind of, how much do you agree with Adam there that Corbyn and Foote were only hindered by a press backlash, by challenging a cultural hegemony? Is that something that you kind of empathise with?
I think all I'll say on this really is I'm very glad Jeremy Corbyn isn't the one leading the COVID-19 response to this country, because I think we'd be in a lot more trouble if we were. I don't think referencing Michael Foote, Adam, here really helps the case here. But I did find the whole point about Keir really quite interesting, just in terms of how he challenges the left policy. Because one thing that's always kind of, you know, baffled me, I know that the Conservative policy on drugs isn't exactly the best and it needs reformation. I recognise that, and it needs reform, and there's a good grassroots movement to kind of drive that forward. But Keir Starmer, he seems to be more interested in penalising cannabis smokers than he does anything else, really. I wonder if it's because when he was in the CPS, he was putting people behind bars for it. So I see a real disconnect between your member base and the leadership here, and I'd be lying if I didn't think it was funny, it's one of those ones where I think it's the heart of the disconnect. You get onto those key button issues in your party, and the leadership is just massively out of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I agree about laughing, because if I wasn't laughing, I'd be crying probably. But yeah, it's what I said about how he got into power in the first place, and that's why there's this disconnect. I think he was quite deceitful for membership. Whilst I don't think he explicitly lied, you know, he was deceitful through his silence. You know, there's a lot of people projecting, they saw Keir Starmer as a person in Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet, and they thought, oh, okay, Keir Starmer might actually be left-wing, he might be a secret lefty that's just trying to play the media, which I thought was absolute bonkers. But a lot of people fell into that trap, and a lot of people just really desperately wanted to win, and they saw Keir Starmer as this, you know, quite approachable candidate in that sense. But if you're actually looking to Keir Starmer's past, like I say, he is an establishment figure. He's a lawyer. He was head of the Crown Prosecution Service. He has done some quite dodgy stuff whilst head of the Crown Prosecution Service. Clamping down on weed smokers. And, you know, it's a shame he hasn't kept that up for the cabinet currently. But, yeah, it is hypocritical. It is massively hypocritical. And then when if you look at Keir Starmer's entry into politics, you know, he was a close friend of Ed Miliband. And I don't know the validity of this, but I have heard from some places, I think I read it somewhere, that the reason he stood to be an MP was because Ed Miliband was offering a cabinet position a few years down the line after he was expecting to win the 2015 election. And then Keir Starmer got in, he was elected, you know, in his quite a safe London seat. And then suddenly Ed Miliband's resigning, Jeremy Corbyn's in, Keir Starmer's looking into the future and thinking, how on earth am I going to get into a sort of further my political career when there's Jeremy Corbyn in charge? So then I think Keir Starmer was quite happy to say, oh yeah, I'm left wing, I'm part of the Socialist Lawyers Association. He isn't anymore, I kicked him out. But you know, he's quite happy to play with the mood of the membership. And now he's tricked enough people into giving him the reins, and there's really nothing we can do. You know, it would be pointless to run a leadership challenge right now. It would be even more self-destructive, I think. But so we just have to live with him until there comes an opportunity where we could maybe have a referendum on his policies and where he's going.
So mentioning he's an establishment figure, mentioning he may have kind of hidden his true beliefs to stay in the party, do you not think, though, so this is perhaps we're moving into a post-populist world, Trump has been defeated, you know, there's certainly questions over Boris Johnson's handling of the pandemic, do you not think that Starmer, as an establishment person, is the ideal leader of the opposition to move the country on from the kind of Johnsonian Corbynite populism, which is in obviously completely different ways but radical and different and pushing against the boundaries of what is in British politics? You don't think that Starmer is perhaps, as Guy said, the basic Tesco meal deal, the calm, patient, quiet promise to return politics to some stability, to return politics to some trust and reliability? You don't think that's worth having in the leader of the opposition?
Keir Starmer is not Clement Attlee. And I say that because I think if you ever do Poly 100 and you buy the Blackwell's books, and the first thing on political philosophy it mentions some prime ministers, and there's a Clement Attlee quote in there, or a quote about Clement Attlee, and it's Attlee wouldn't use one word where none would suffice. And he was like, that led to him accusations of him being quite sheepish or not wanting to take on Churchill. Because I think I'm not going to compare Johnson to Churchill, but I think the persona-wise, they might be similar. And I think there's perhaps something you can draw on there. And I think Keir Starmer wanted to be that sort of Attlee-type figure, you know, a quiet planner, working in the background. People trust his judgment. They trust that he's going to make sensible decisions. They trust that he knows what he's on about, and he'll get the job done when given the opportunity. And I think perhaps that strategy could have worked, like I said earlier, if we were in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think if you look across the world, the countries that have more radical left-wing policies, more radical left-wing governments, they have been dealing so much better with the COVID-19 pandemic. So I took offence to what Guy said earlier about being glad that Jeremy Corbyn isn't in charge. I think if Jeremy Corbyn was in charge of our handling of the pandemic, we wouldn't have over 100,000 people dead. You know, I think we would be able to say goodbye to our loved ones at funerals. You know, I think we would be able to do a lot more. I think perhaps even, you know, we might be able to see people in the park right now. That kind of thing. I think a more socialised view is necessary to deal with a pandemic. I think pandemics are very clearly a sign of when the government is important and when state intervention is important. If we look at the vaccine rollout has been one of the great successes recently. But I think the main reason it's been successful is because the government haven't interfered in it. They've just let the NHS roll out the vaccines. Whereas the test and trace system that was outsourced to Serco, was outsourced to a cabinet minister's spouse, you know, and that was a disaster when it first went up. It took months to get that working correctly. And then just the general cronyism that's come about from this government is despicable. I mean, Matt Hancock, and they found that he basically gave a £30 million contract to manufacture, I think it was vials for the vaccine, glass vials, to his mate that has a pub in his constituency, that has a business that has absolutely no experience in medical supplies. It's ridiculous, it's laughable. That wasn't on the front page of many newspapers. And then Keir Starmer, I mean, Guy was saying earlier that Keir Starmer, all he does is call for people to resign. He hasn't even called for Matt Hancock to resign. He's gave £30 million to his friend, and Keir Starmer's just said that's acceptable. It sends the completely wrong message, and as you can probably tell, it does infuriate me.
Just before I ask Guy to invite, do you need to specify that Matt Hancock denies the accusations, and that has specified that he wasn't involved in the signing of that contract. So this is to a degree alleged, but there's certainly questions. Guy, Adam has covered a lot of ground there.
I have a suspicion you might want to respond. I'll tackle the Jeremy Corbyn issue head on. I think we'd have probably had a poll from Momentum on masks at the beginning of the pandemic if he was in power. But I think the socialist mantra, remember, we've got one of the first vaccine that we had in this country was Pfizer. And Pfizer is completely privately funded vaccine. That's why it's a £25 a jab, basically, to the NHS, because it's a privately funded vaccine. The amazing work of the private sector to absolutely vaccinate through Pfizer, you know, which was the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine was the first one to be rolled out globally, basically. And it's the one that's kicked off our vaccination program. And I don't think Corbyn would have allowed that to happen because, you know, his socialist, communist-like core inside probably would have stopped it from doing that in the first place, in my opinion. His ego wouldn't have listened to the scientists, in my opinion. I think we'd have been in a very similar state regardless who is leader. In terms of our pandemic response, but I'm much more glad that we've got competent Conservative government in place in the first place. I'll tackle the test and trace. So I'll dispel the thing about the Serco thing, because Serco's involvement was actually quite limited when you actually look at the figures of how much Serco's involvement in test and trace. Yes, of course, there were issues, but you're scaling up a test and trace program to cover 60-odd million people from zero, basically. So, as much as I dislike test and trace, it's got a lot better. We've got a massive testing system where we're testing half a million people a day. You know, I had my lateral flow test on campus yesterday, and it was seamless. It was fantastic to get that result in 20 minutes, and I was on my way into the library. So it was brilliant. So I'm pleased with where we're at with test and trace, and I think the government's managed to shape that around. In terms of the Matt Hancock allegedness, look, at the beginning of the pandemic, 2% of PPE in this country was produced in Britain. The rest of it was imported. And that's another topic for another day on how we protect national national industry, but 2%. So I don't doubt that for a short time, the bureaucratic procedures that we have in place for competition purposes were suspended while we managed to get as much PPE into this country as possible. Now it's up in the 90% of it being produced in this country. So, I'm incredibly proud to say that that's happening. And there's going to be inquiry at the end of the day. Mistakes will have been made, and let's rectify it. Let's learn for the future. But I think it's wrong to think that the Labour Party wouldn't have turned to the private sector in the day. And if they hadn't, we'd have been a much worse mess. And I'd say just on the vaccine rollout, when when Adam's kind of just quickly just mentioned there about the government staying out of the vaccine, they've been very hands-on. The fact that we've had an appointed vaccines minister at the heart of this rollout is part of it. And it's the army that's been involved, not the NHS. Now, the NHS is going to need some serious work after this pandemic. It's going to need gutting. It's going to need sorting out from a bureaucratic structure. It's too bureaucratic, and it's slowed down a lot of the processes. But it's the army getting involved in the vaccine rollout that's really sped us up, getting it into that supply chain and getting it into the arms of the British people. So, yeah, I'm much more confident with Boris being in charge. As much as he flounders sometimes, I think he's much better than Corbyn ever would be.
Am I allowed to come in there, Theo?
You can. I'm just going to keep an eye on the time, so if you can keep your response nice and succinct, still firm and fair, but succinct.
I'll keep an eye on it. I prattled on a bit last time, I'll admit. Yeah. So I'm just thinking back to the 2019 manifesto, and there's a lot of policies in that I think would have definitely helped in the pandemic. You know, people chastised the, you know, nationalised internet, the free internet, the, you know, fast, high speed for everyone. But I think right now in the middle of this pandemic, especially if you're doing home learning and if you have very slow internet like me, or if you don't have access to a computer, I think that policy would, you know, help bridge the education gap that's going to ultimately come from this pandemic and the online learning. I think that would be really important. It would also help people connect with each other and see each other video calling. Regarding the vaccines, I know there was a Labour policy where we wanted to introduce generic patents of branded medication, so we allow them to purchase them at a lower price. I'll also add that the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine that was being produced, I mean, it did come out slightly later than the Pfizer vaccine, but I think it was a matter of weeks, if anything, and that was being publicly produced. That was an open-source vaccine that anyone could work on until the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation stepped in and bought it out and forced it to partner with AstraZeneca. So we would have had a publicly developed vaccine maybe a week or two later than the Pfizer one, but we still would have had a public vaccine. I think things like furlough and payments would have been so much better under the Jeremy Corbyn government. I think a lot of people wouldn't have to be forced to risk their lives in the service industry to go into work, you know, just to keep the economy open. I don't think all those people would have died under a Jeremy Corbyn government. But I do realise this is pointless now because we don't have a Jeremy Corbyn government. We're not going to have a Jeremy Corbyn government, sadly.
I think
there is socialist policy that would massively have helped deal with this vaccine, deal with this pandemic, sorry.
It's very like Corbynism to just jump into a discussion, you know, 1.5 years too late on Keir Starmer and the government. I didn't necessarily see that one coming. We are running a bit over time, so I'm going to wrap up that topic now. Thank you for those of you who texted in. I'm afraid the messages came in a bit too late to discuss them, but I'll read the number again. And if you do want to text them, we'd love to hear your thoughts. And I will put your question to our esteemed guests. So the number, I'm just going to read that again, is 01524 566 549. Okay, so we're going to have to whiz through the alternative news roundup before we get onto the royal family. So, time to look away from the Washington Westminster News Access and report on some of the big stories from around the world and under your nose. This is the alternative news roundup. In Myanmar, at least two protesters have been killed amid general upheaval against a military coup 2 weeks ago. In Mandalay, dispersed crowds of strikers and protesters, police used live ammunition in response to people throwing projectiles at them. UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has warned that the shooting of peaceful protesters in Myanmar is beyond the pale, although there have been peaceful protests across the rest of the country. The military junta now ruling Myanmar insists it's only responding to a fraudulent election last November, fraud which it has not yet provided proof. Health authorities in Guinea last week declared an Ebola outbreak in the southern town of Guéqué. 3 cases were reported after a nurse contracted the disease and died, passing on to several funeral goers. This is the first time the West African nation has faced Ebola since the 2014 epidemic. And Dr. Mashatiso, the WHO Regional Director for Africa, has reported it as a huge concern. However, Guinea has proven itself capable of responding to Ebola before, for instance, sending health workers to the Democratic Republic of Congo to contain an outbreak there. And a German court today concluded the first ever trial over alleged atrocities by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad regime. It today sentenced a former Syrian intelligence officer to 4.5 years in jail for complicity in crimes against humanity. Eyal Hagalib had fled the country and sought asylum in Germany before being arrested 2 years ago with another Syrian who remains on trial. It's thought that Al-Khalib was involved in torturing over 30 protesters, or complicit in torturing over 30 protesters in 2011, when the first upheavals against Assad's regime occurred in Damascus. Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's Middle East editor, has called it a legal landmark. But on to the second debate topic of today. The royal family. The Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip, was last week admitted to hospital as a precaution, and he's likely to remain there for a few more days. The palace has confirmed his stay is not related to coronavirus, but the Duke is nearly 70, where'd that come from? He's nearly 100, and every time he goes to hospital, there's always an uncertainty about whether or how he'll leave again. The Queen is 94 and slowly reducing her duties to allow Charles, the Prince of Wales, to step up. When the Duke and the Queen are no longer here, as they probably will no longer be in the next decade or so, there will be debate about where the royal family fits in British society. Adam, there's a big question here. I'm going to go to you with it. Is the royal family still relevant?
Right. So I am going to have to present a bit of a nuanced argument here.
We love nuanced arguments. Go for it. Yeah.
In my heart, like, according to my ideals, the royal family should not exist. It is not representative of the society we want to have in Britain. You know, a primogeniture should not be a thing in the 21st century. We shouldn't have the concept of royal blood. We shouldn't have the idea that you're born into wealth being so entrenched into our country. But on the other hand, and I say this as a politics student who's had to read about the British Constitution or the lack of one so many times, if you remove the Queen, if you remove the monarch as a head of state, you have to completely reimagine what the British state looks like. And there's so many constitutional issues where it almost becomes not worth getting rid of the royal family. So I think my simplified line would be reduce like the number of like main royals, cut down on the extended royal family, stop giving the Queen money, essentially, and just keep them in place in that constitutional placeholder slot, even though they don't really do anything with it. It's still important to how our system operates.
Okay, so you're saying there's a kind of functional role they play which is better than any alternative, or easier to work with than any alternative. Guy, what's your take?
Oh, I can't believe what I'm hearing. A base take from the Labour Party. I like it. I like this. I have to agree with Adam on this point, that the royal, you know, royalism is you know, fundamental to this country. It's a system that has worked quite clearly for many, many years, and it has evolved into a system where we elect a government, we have a bicameral legislative system, and the Queen simply acts as a figurehead and rubber stamps it. That is a fantastic system. It is a de facto, basically just like the states in that sense, because you invest the power still within the Prime Minister and the elected people of this country. It's just simply rubber marked by a system that's been in place for so many years. I do have to kind of admit here on this sense that we don't give the Queen really any money. She owns a lot of this country. She owns a lot of land. The sovereign fund, or you know, the Crown Estate, owns an awful lot of land and gets a lot of its income from that. And any money that the British taxpayer does kind of pay to her is reaped in the tourism benefits that we get in this country. I think it's really hard to kind of understate sometimes just how valuable they are as a family and as a figurehead to this country. I do think, however, that their treatment of you know the likes of Harry and Meghan, and of course our Princess Di, their treatment of those in their family who they don't get on with is, you know, something that needs to be called out a bit more, I think. And their treatment of certain royals, who we won't name, who goes to a Pizza Express in Woking, needs to be kind of, I think, exploited a bit more in terms of the British media, because I think we don't tackle it enough, in my opinion, and how to deal with it. I mean, the Meghan Markle side of things, I'm not going to say anything, but if the royal family have a history, you know, God knows what's going to happen next. So let's not speculate on that. But in terms of where I think they've gone wrong, and it's it's one of these ones where you see it in their society pieces. So let's take Harry and Meghan Markle, for example. And I think it's a broader piece on the British media and the British people, to an extent, on social media, how we kind of approach it from a royal perspective. So Meghan Markle and Harry obviously have now severed their ties with the Queen. And the royal family, to an extent, officially. And she posts a picture of her with Harry, with her baby bump, on a picture on social media, and she's suddenly called out for being wanting attention. Now, I completely see the opposite. She came out at the back end of last year with the agonising pain that she'd had a miscarriage, something which 1 in 8 women in this country suffer, and 1 in 100 have that more than 3 times in a row. Something so horrific, and then post such a wonderful image of her managing, you know, to achieve, you know, a wonderful thing, which we all appreciate. And to have her vilified in the social media, saying she wants attention, I can't get my head around that sometimes. And I think it's a symptom of the British media sometimes, its fixation. It happened with Diana, and it's happening again. So for once again, we are in a bit of agreement, aren't we, Adam?
It's interesting. I never would have thought the Conservative guest on the show would be so, you know, what Conservative's ever positive towards the royal family? That came out of nowhere, Guy, that enthusiasm for the traditions of this country. But I'm going to press you on this, in fact, because when we come to, you say that the system works, but when it comes to major constitutional matters, when Johnson broke Parliament in 2019, when Blair conducted devolution in 2000, there was no real oversight to that. As long as you have a majority, as long as you have the powers of the core executive, as Mark Garnett repeatedly got on about in PPR 233, but there's no effective oversight. Do you not think, regardless of your decision on Brexit and on devolution, both of those things have caused significant problems? Would it not do well, Guy, to have someone else in the room saying, are you sure? Because I'm not sure. Are you sure? Does that make sense?
No, I kind of appreciate what you're saying, and that's why the House of Lords is an effective governing system in that sense, because that's the whole point, isn't it? You're holding elected figures to account with years of expertise in either business or, you know, British culture and British society, holding them to account together. And obviously, I think until the recent times, a lot of it was packed with Blair's cronies. So it's one of these ones where you kind of devalue the whole system in this country if you start dismantling it like that. Of course, yeah, maybe a presidential system would work in this country in 1,000 years after you've spent all that time dismantling everything all the way up to Magna Carta. It simply isn't worth it, is it? I personally think the law lords should be still here. I don't think the Supreme Court should have been established. The law lords work perfectly fine.
That's a very spicy take.
Let's not get on the law lords, Guy. Roll yourself back. Okay, Adam, sure, I can hear some snickers coming from your call. I suspect you've got something to say.
Yeah, I think the House of Lords needs work. Again, I don't think it, in its current state, it represents what we want in a society. We shouldn't have any hereditary peers in there. I think the appointment system is flawed at best. I think either you need some sort of democratically elected second house, or you need to massively look at the way that lords are appointed. I think regarding your question, Theo, about oversight, I think the Supreme Court and the judiciary did do a really good job, you know, regarding the prorogation of Parliament, regarding the Brexit vote and all the shenanigans that went on there. The Supreme Court, in the end, you know, it did take challenges and time, but the Supreme Court did actually work quite well in that sense. And I think my worry about having sort of like this presidential oversight that, you know, to like ask, like, are you sure? I can see some benefits of that, but I think all that would do is just cement the status quo. It would keep us locked in to whatever system we were in when we implemented that. If we look at America, their political system is known for gridlock. It's known for not getting anything done. It's known for compromise. And I think one of the great things about the British parliamentary system is that once you give someone a mandate to be prime minister, they can enact their policy. They can actually do what people voted for them to do. And I don't think I'd want to change that. Yeah, I think if a left-wing candidate came into a presidential system, like, for example, if Bernie Sanders won the presidency, if he won the nomination, then won the presidency in America, he would not be able to do what he wanted to do because of how fixed the American system is, of how much it wants to preserve how it already is. Whereas if Jeremy Corbyn or another left-wing candidate would have came in and won the UK elections, they would be able to actually enact their change. And I think, like, Clement Attlee, again, is a great example of this. You know, he was elected on a landslide majority and massively changed how British society was.
Okay, but don't you think the British... Because, as you say, we have no codified constitution. We don't have an American-style constitution. And it kind of works, but what if you have a Prime Minister like Boris Johnson who wants to approach Parliament, or like David Cameron and Nick Clegg, who wants to regulate how often an election can be called? Because the British constitution, the British system of politics is a bit like cricket. No one quite understands how it works, but it does, because people are quite nice towards each other. And it's, what happens when people stop being... I mean, leaving the cricket analogy aside now, when people stop playing by the gentleman's rules, does it continue to function? Because if Boris Johnson has vast powers, again going back to the core executive theory, and the Prime Minister has been accumulating them for decades now, can we be so sure? And Guy, I'm going to invite you to come in on this. Actually, can we be so sure the Prime Minister will continue to respect that to the point we don't need someone else whispering in his ear? Are you sure?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of going back to your previous point about oversight, I do think you need a strong law system in this country anyway, and I like to think that we do at the moment. And you know, as much as I disagree with a lot of the Brexit court trials, etc., I do think it shows that we do have a system in this country that kind of works. Going back to Adam's point and actually being able to pass legislation in this country, I think I love this parliament, and I love parliament for the kind of key purpose that no other one parliament can bind another. It's once you democratically elect a parliament, they can change what they like. I personally think the Fixed Term Parliament Act was a piece of constitutional vandalism that the Liberal Democrats did because they thought the Tories were going to kick them out of power. So, you know, I think that reflects more on the Lib Dems.
Well, certainly Tory party.
But yeah, no, I appreciate that point then. I think from when we kind of look at the core executive theory, do we need more oversight? Yes. And I think that's, again, it's kind of where Parliament comes into it. The select committees, the liaison committee in recent years has shown itself to be incredibly powerful at holding prime ministers to account when they become a slightly more presidential. They kind of solidify power in number 10. And I think it's been a good method. And I think it's kind of... sometimes we do underestimate the power of backbenchers. You've seen in the Tory party especially, and in the Labour party, just how much backbenchers can topple ministers on the front bench if they haven't got a tight majority. When we had Theresa May, remember, it was gridlock off the gridlock if people abandoned her and she didn't have the support of the DUP. So again, I think our parliament is the mother of all when it comes down to it. And I think the world, whilst it's changed in it, the American system has got a constitution which, again, brings up its own problems. If we had a codified constitution in this country, we'd have to go down that whole amendment process, the Supreme Court making rulings on everything. It's just not for this country, I don't think.
Okay. So... this is the problem. You get someone from Labour on, you get someone from Conservative on, and they agree on both of the big debate topics you have. This is a real problem. I'm not sure how we're gonna deal with this in future. Just going back though, because the original point of discussion was the royal family, and one final point on this. We originally were aiming to talk about kind of what happens when the Queen, the Duke are no longer here. And I would like to kind of have a quick discussion on that. And Guy, I'll come back to you. How would the new generation of the royal family, Charles and Camilla, and then William as Prince of Wales, they would have to change? You know, there are things that need updating, things that need changing. How should they change? How should they change what they do to keep relevant to Britain?
Yeah, definitely. And I think this kind of comes down to the whole Harry and Meghan thing. It's a shame they've been pushed out. They feel like they've been pushed out so soon. Mm. If when eventually the Queen very sadly passes on, we are going to be left with Charles. And I don't think Charles will be... I think it'll be too stubborn to pass it straight on to William, as many people probably like in this country, and give the generations, the younger generations of this country a chance and a say, because I think that's going to be the stumbling block, in my opinion. I think if you passed it over to William... and you let Kate, be Princess Kate next to it, basically de facto queen in that sense next to him, I think that the monarchy has a greater chance, and there'll be much less of an option for political parties to go down the whole disestablishmentarianism route, because it's going down that route where I think that if you don't open up, I think the crown Crown is a really nice contemporary example of where I think people have taken a much more interest in the royal family. I mean, it goes back to that 1960s film that The Crown actually does touch on, where the royal family released that horrendously stereotypical video of themselves that showed them prowling around Britain, and that created a lot of anger. And I think that if they don't shape up and they don't become more open, more transparent in their duties, or more down to earth in that sense, I think it's going to cause, especially potentially more in Adam's party than in my party, certainly a greater resurgence. So I think eventually in the next decade or 2 decades, probably, you will have a Labour leader, if Charles potentially becomes king, you will have a Labour leader or a Lib Dem leader, most likely because they pick a side every day. But I think you'll have a Labour leader who's backing the end of the monarchy, bar Jeremy Corbyn, obviously.
Okay, and Adam, final thoughts again on how they need to change before we move on to our final discussion topic. How does the royal family need to change to the new generation?
I think the point about them feeling very outdated is very valid. Again, I think they need to cut the excess. I think just keep it to the mainstream royals, if that.
No spin-off series.
There's a lot of, I don't want to say like dead weight, but there is a lot of dead weight. I don't think people particularly care about Princess Beatrice or, you know, some of like, you know, Prince Andrew, Prince Edward. You know, I don't think those people are vital for the royal family. They're not vital for the country, certainly. I think we could get rid of like a lot of those. I think hangers-on is a term that's sometimes used. I don't see any political party calling for the abolition of the monarchy, though. I can't see that happening. Like, I know in my circles, I know even just like up north with my family, people I speak to, as well as people I speak to at university, there isn't any love for the Queen particularly. But I don't know what the national picture is. I think a lot of people still like the idea of Queen and country. So I think it would be political suicide to suggest abolishing the monarchy, even if it might come a point when it's the right idea.
Okay, so finally, we always end on a more, where we ran very over, we only got a few minutes, we always end on a more kind of light-hearted topic. So 3 Cubans have been rescued from a desert island in the Bahamas after reportedly living on coconuts and rats for over a month. Thankfully, bar fatigue and dehydration, they are uninjured and broadly fine. Guy, you're stranded on a desert island by yourself. Assuming there's fresh water, what's your plan?
Stay there indefinitely. I'm sure it would be a nice quality of life, actually, being on your own desert island, relaxed in the sun, have coconuts, fresh drinking water. Go for it. You're living the life.
Fair enough. Adam, similar plan?
Yeah, I think I'd probably try to get through my reading list.
Bring a big stack of books with you, so when you get shipwrecked, they'll float to shore. Anything particular on the reading list you're looking to get to?
There's a few pieces of theory I probably want to look at more. I want to like looking to Antonio Gramsci more. I'm only halfway through State and Revolution at the moment, so I want to get through that. And then I think a few novels as well for light reading.
Very nice. I feel slightly underqualified to be hosting this show now. You've both got better plans than I do for a desert island. But we are coming to the end of our programme today. Hope you at home enjoyed this week's episode of Newspeak, the most controversial show on Lank Fashions. We have been Freedom of Speech going live. All that remains is to thank our wonderful guests, Adam and Guy. You've both been brilliant. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversations. I've been Theo Hunt, and we'll be back same time next week. Have a great afternoon. Enjoy this final song, To the Dreamers, by King and Country. When you